Afterword. Chinese philosophy. It's been said that the West has never really understood Chinese philosophy. Indeed, many Oriental thinkers claim it is impossible for the Western mind to grasp such subtleties of which it has no conception. Almost all Western philosophers have maintained a similar view, usually regarding the reception by Western civilization of their own philosophy, so we should not be unduly put off by this insistence on mutual incomprehension. Chinese philosophy is different from Western philosophy, just as the Chinese are different from Europeans. But we are all equally worthless, or precious, sub specie aeterni, beneath the gaze of eternity. We all inhabit the same human condition, and this is what every philosophy claims to examine. So Chinese philosophy may have its inadequacies in our eyes, as ours may have in theirs, but they are both prescriptions for a similar complaint. Life. Chinese philosophy as such came into being from the 6th century BC onward. During this period there developed the Hundred Schools, which were as diverse and divergent as their name suggests. These consisted largely of wandering philosophers who travelled among the different states that then made up China. Upon arrival the philosopher would set up shop and begin giving philosophical advice of one sort or another. This was usually given to the court and frequently consisted of various principles intended to help with the government of the state. Inevitably, such advice was seldom tolerated for long, and the philosopher soon found himself back on the road. The philosophies produced by the Hundred Schools were often unrecognizable as philosophy, according to the Western notion of this subject. Frequently, these philosophies were little more than an attitude to life, elaborated in a number of pithy or enigmatic sayings. Their actual philosophy was seldom structured or argued in any consistent, logical manner, and was often closer to political advice on the one hand or religion on the other. The main example of the former was Confucianism, and the latter, Taoism. These soon emerged as the two dominant strains of thought in Chinese philosophy. Later they were both to be affected by the arrival of the third main strain in Chinese philosophy, Buddhism. Confucianism. The teachings that originated with Confucius have lasted, in one form or another, to this day. Confucianism is essentially practical. It is concerned with how to live on the personal and social levels. For this reason its main topics are ethics and politics. There is little speculation about the meaning and ultimate nature of life. Metaphysics is, for the most part, absent. This has been true of Confucianism since its beginning more than 2.5 millennia ago, and continues to be true of Neo-Confucianism in its present diffuse form. Confucianism has shown that it is possible to conduct one's life without recourse to metaphysical speculation. After 2,500 years, Western thinking appears, reluctantly and very gradually, to be coming round to the same point of view. Taoism. Taoism springs from the Chinese word Tao, which means the way. All Chinese philosophers had their views about Tao, but Taoism itself derived from those held by the sage Lao Tzu and his later follower Chuang Tzu. Lao Tzu lived during the 6th century BC, but little is known of his life. He is said to have been a historian and religious advisor to the court of the Chao emperors. According to legend, he met Confucius and was not impressed. Later he is said to have set off for the West. At the Xianku Pass, the guardian of the pass refused to allow him to leave China until he had written down his teachings about the Tao. This book was named the Tao Te Ching, and was to become the holy writ of Taoism. Lao Tzu then departed for the West, and, according to a contemporary report, nobody knows what has become of him. Many among the Hundred Schools looked upon Lao Tzu as a sage, a saint, or even a deity. Even contemporary Confucians are said to have regarded him as a great philosopher. This is difficult to understand, as the teachings of Lao Tzu are complementary to those of Confucius. In the view of some, these two philosophers deal with entirely different realms of human endeavour. In the view of others, they are utterly contradictory on almost every issue. Where Confucius taught the way of man, Lao Tzu taught the way of nature. For Lao Tzu, the way was a largely metaphysical, mystical conception. It was the eternal and absolute force that controls nature, but it remains beyond space and time. This is difficult to grasp in the logical, conceptual terms normally required of philosophical discourse by Western thinkers, yet it is not, as is sometimes claimed, extraneous to philosophy as we know it in the West. Stoicism and the philosophy advocated by the Cynics were likewise fundamentally attitudes toward the world. According to Lao Tzu, we should attune ourselves to the Tao by attempting to emulate it. We should empty ourselves of petty concerns, dedicate our lives to simplicity and spontaneity, yet at the same time remain tranquil. When conveyed by an exemplary teacher such as Lao Tzu, Taoism doubtless had great force, but a certain amount of elaboration was needed if Taoism was to remain viable even as a metaphysical philosophy. This was provided by Chuang Tzu, who was born a couple of centuries after Lao Tzu. Again, little is known of his life except that he wrote the book which is now named after him, the Chuang Tzu, and that he vehemently attacked Confucianism. In his later years he is said to have become a delightful old eccentric, dressed in rags, with his disintegrating shoes held together by bits of string. One of his disciples visited Chuang Tzu after his wife had died, and was disconcerted to find him happily singing away to himself and beating time on his bowl. Chuang Tzu defended his behaviour by saying that to weep and mourn would have been to display an ignorance of destiny. For Chuang Tzu, the Tao transforms haphazard and conflicting nature into the harmonious unity of the way of nature. This happens only when nature follows nature with a capital N, and is achieved by us when we too follow the way of nature, rather than the way of man as recommended by Confucius. The Tao, or way of nature, is a transcendent state where good and evil no longer exist, and all things live in harmonious equality. But Chuang Tzu also maintained that the Tao was everywhere and existed in all things, even down to ants and excrement. On his deathbed he forbade his pupils from giving him any kind of formal funeral, saying he preferred to be left so that he could be eaten by carrion crows rather than buried and eaten by worms. Buddhism. Buddhism arrived in China in the 3rd century AD from India. During its long period of development away from the country of its origin, Buddhism underwent a peculiarly Chinese transformation, which owes much to its numerous similarities to Taoism. Buddhism is considered by Westerners as more of a religion than a philosophy, but one has only to look at scholasticism in the Middle Ages to see how these two essentially separate modes of thought can become inextricably entwined. Regarded in this light, Buddhism is certainly a philosophy as well as a religion, its metaphysics being quite the equal of scholasticism, or Taoism for that matter. Unlike the scholastics, however, the Buddhists tended to believe in a laissez-faire fatalism, especially with regard to schisms. As a result, it wasn't long before Buddhism diverged into a wide variety of religio-philosophies. These all insisted upon calling themselves Buddhism, despite the fact that many of them were inimical to one another. The parallels with Christian thought are again all too evident, with the difference that in such times of difficulty, Buddhists prefer to set fire to themselves, rather than each other. Buddhism was founded by Siddhartha Gautama, who was born in Nepal in the mid-6th century BC. After getting married at 16 and living a life of luxury for another 13 years, he abandoned everything and set off for India, where he became a vagabond ascetic. In danger of wasting away through his overzealous approach to asceticism, he eventually decided to follow his own path to enlightenment. According to legend, he finally achieved this enlightenment around 528 BC at the age of 35, and thus became Buddha. This happened while he was meditating cross-legged beneath a banyan, or East Indian fig tree, Ficus religiosa. Initially, Buddhism placed great emphasis on meditation, which gave one sufficient spiritual tranquility and detachment to free oneself from the delusions and contradictions of life in the everyday world. These daily snares are like clouds obscuring the sun. Only when they are dissolved by spiritual discipline do we become aware of the radiant truth. Chinese Buddhism was greatly influenced by Taoism, which was prevalent in China at the time of Buddhism's arrival. Later, Buddhism was to have its own influence over the development of Confucianism in the 11th century, This Neo-Confucianism absorbed from Buddhism metaphysical concerns which would have been anathema to Confucius himself, but appear to fill a gap in his teachings for his followers. The Sayings of Confucius. Confucius's advice on how to be a good administrator and the effect of this. Chuan Sun Shi asked the master, "What must I do to become a superior man and enter government service?" "You must respect the five high qualities and abhor the four evils." "What are these five high qualities?" "The superior man is gracious without accepting bribes. He works alongside people without giving cause for resentment. He has ambitions, but he is not avaricious. He is dignified, but without undue pride. He inspires respect, but is not cruel." "What precisely do you mean by these qualities?" "To work for the advantage of the people. Isn't this being generous without accepting bribes? If you give the right job to the right person, who will be resentful? If a man, out of desire to fulfill himself, achieves all he is capable of, how can he be greedy? The superior man always takes on his tasks, regardless of their difficulty or size, and thus is not slothful. This surely is dignity without pride. The superior man takes care about his appearance. He wears his clothes and hat in the proper manner, and treats others with respect. And owing to his serious demeanor, people have great regard for him. In this way he inspires respect without being cruel." "And what are the four evils?" "To put a man to death because he failed in his task when he wasn't given the proper instructions, this is cruelty. To expect a man to do something without the proper advice, this is an outrage. To insist that a man rushes to complete his task when he has been told to perform it thoroughly, this is detrimental. To promise a reward and then begrudge paying it, this is small-mindedness." Sayings of Confucius. A few more tips for good government. If a ruler himself is upright in his own person, then there will be obedience without orders having to be given. But if he himself is not upright, there will not be obedience even if orders are given. "If only some ruler would employ me, I'd have everything sorted out within a month, and within 3 years I would have the whole place running smoothly." Speaking of government, the master told Cheng Yu, "Only ask others to do what you have first taught them." Sayings of Confucius. Confucius emphasizes the need for study and comments on our general attitude toward it. "Study as if you will never learn, as if you were afraid of losing what you wish to learn." It is difficult to find a man who is willing to study for 3 years without getting a job at the end of it. Sayings of Confucius. Some penetrating observations by the great master. Don't anticipate fraud or deceitfulness, but at the same time always be on the lookout for them. This is necessary if you wish to get to the top. Someone who is keen on bravery but complains of being poor is going to create trouble. Some people can be made to do things without being able to understand them. Sayings of Confucius. Some not-so-penetrating observations by the great master. When the weather becomes cold, we notice that the pines and firs are the last to fade. When asked for further advice on government, the master replied, "Never grow weary." The master said of Kang Tzu Ching of Wei, "He knows how to enjoy things. When he first became successful, he would say, 'This is just about right.' When he became a bit more successful, he would say, 'This is just about enough.' And when he became highly successful, he would say, 'This is just about perfect.'" Sayings of Confucius. Confucius's celebrated description of himself and the stages of his life. "When I was 15, I was only interested in studying. When I was 30, I began my life. At 40, I was self-assured. At 50, I understood my place in the vast scheme of things. At 60, I learned to give up arguing, and now, at 70, I can do whatever I like without disrupting my life." Sayings of Confucius. A court official asked Confucius if the Lord Chao always obeyed the rites and observances, and Confucius replied that he did. When Confucius left, the official said, "I was told that the great master Confucius was a wise man, but I can see that he is not. The Lord Chao contravened the observances by taking a wife from amongst his own family, and disguised this fact by giving her a different name. When Confucius was told of this, he replied, "When I make a mistake, you can be sure that everyone will get to hear about it." Sayings of Confucius. A typical example of the master's pragmatism, wisdom, and advice about life. Be of unwavering good faith. Love learning. Be prepared to defend the good way with your life. Do not enter a state that is unstable. Never live in a state where there is revolution. Strive to shine when the way prevails in the empire. When it does not prevail, then hide. It is shameful to be poor and unknown in a country where the way prevails. Likewise, it is shameful to be rich and honored in a country where the way does not prevail. Sayings of Confucius. The nearest Confucius comes to revealing a definitive theory of fashion. The superior man should not wear a crimson or plum-colored collar on his clothes. The garments that he wears when he is indoors should not be colored scarlet or violet. In summer he should wear about the house a single gown made of rough or fine hemp. When he goes outside, he should at all times put on a gown. In winter he should wear a black outer gown over a wool-lined garment. When wearing an undyed gown, his inner garment should be lined with deerskin. When wearing his yellow gown, his inner garment should be lined with fox fur. When he is at home, he should wear a lined gown that is longer than the one he wears for ceremonial occasions. This should have a short right sleeve so that he can use his arm. When going to bed, he must always wear a nightshirt, which should be half as long again as his body. At home, his gowns should be lined with fox or badger fur. He should always wear all his badges of office hanging from his sash, except at funerals. His clothes must always be well tailored, apart from when he attends sacrifices. When visiting someone in mourning, he should never wear a gown lined with wool or a black hat. On the first day of the month, he should visit his prince dressed in formal wear. When he is undertaking a fast, he should at all times wear clean hempen robes. Sayings of Confucius. Some commentators have considered this advice to be so detailed that it does in fact constitute a genuine theory of fashion. My own view is that this is not the case, owing to its lack of abstract principles and certain inherent contradictions which remain unresolved. What, for instance, should the superior man wear if he is attending a sacrifice in the company of his prince on the first day of the month? Some Western comments. I respect Confucius. He was the first man who did not receive divine inspiration. Voltaire. What he transmitted was the values which the Chinese people for ages before him had cherished. So it's not so much that China is Confucian as that Confucianism is Chinese. William McNaughton. If we have to choose one word to characterize Confucian ethics, that word would have to be humanity. The main concern of Confucian ethics is the whole process of learning to be human. This process involves a total commitment, a continuous effort of self-refinement or self-improvement, and a holistic vision of the entire project of moral education. Dr. Tu Weiming, Professor of Chinese History and Philosophy, Harvard University. Confucius was more concerned with the necessities of government and of government administration than any other philosopher. Ezra Pound. Chronology of Confucius's life. 551 BC, birth of Confucius, possibly on September 28th, which is still celebrated as his birthday in parts of East Asia. 548 BC, death of Confucius's father. 536 BC, becomes obsessed with learning. 533 BC, marries Pei Yu. Circa 520 to 510 BC, sets up school teaching his new religion. Circa 509 to 500 BC, appointed minister of crime in province of Lu. Circa 500 BC, resigns from public office in province of Lu. Circa 500 to 490 BC, sets off on pilgrimage looking for further employment. 484 BC, returns home to province of Lu. 479 BC, death of Confucius at age 73. Chronology of significant philosophical dates. 6th century BC, The Beginning of Western Philosophy with Thales of Miletus. End of 6th century BC. Death of Pythagoras. 399 BC. Socrates sentenced to death in Athens. Circa 387 BC, Plato founds the Academy in Athens, the first university. 335 BC, Aristotle founds the Lyceum in Athens, a rival school to the Academy. 324 AD, Emperor Constantine moves capital of Roman Empire to Byzantium. 400 AD, St. Augustine writes his Confessions, philosophy absorbed into Christian theology. 410 AD, Sack of Rome by Visigoths heralds opening of Dark Ages. 529 AD, Closure of Academy in Athens by Emperor Justinian marks end of Hellenic thought. Mid-13th century, Thomas Aquinas writes his Commentaries on Aristotle, Era of Scholasticism. 1453, Fall of Byzantium to Turks, end of Byzantine Empire. 1492, Columbus reaches America. Renaissance in Florence and revival of interest in Greek learning. 1543. Copernicus publishes On the Revolution of the Celestial Orbs, proving mathematically that the Earth revolves around the Sun. 1633. Galileo forced by Church to recant heliocentric theory of the universe. 1641. Descartes publishes his Meditations, the start of modern philosophy. 1677. Death of Spinoza allows publication of his Ethics. 1687. Newton publishes Principia, introducing concept of gravity. 1689. Locke publishes Essay Concerning Human Understanding, start of empiricism. 1710. Berkeley publishes Principles of Human Knowledge, Advancing Empiricism to New Extremes. 1716. Death of Leibniz. 1739-1740. Hume publishes Treatise of Human Nature, taking empiricism to its logical limits. 1781. Kant, awakened from his dogmatic slumbers by Hume, publishes Critique of Pure Reason. Great era of German metaphysics begins. 1807. Hegel publishes The Phenomenology of Mind, high point of German metaphysics. 1818. Schopenhauer publishes The World as Will and Representation, introducing Indian philosophy into German metaphysics. 1889. Nietzsche, having declared God is dead, succumbs to madness in Turin. 1921. Wittgenstein publishes Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, claiming the final solution to the problems of philosophy. 1920s. Vienna Circle propounds Logical Positivism. 1927. Heidegger publishes Being and Time, heralding split between analytical and continental philosophy. 1943. Sartre publishes Being and Nothingness, advancing Heidegger's thought and instigating existentialism. 1953. Posthumous publication of Wittgenstein's Philosophical Investigations. High era of linguistic analysis. This concludes the reading of Confucius in 90 Minutes by Paul Strathern, 1999. This book was read by Robert Whitfield. Unabridged recording, 2004. Thank you.